Sound. Hello, everybody. Joining us via Zoom as well as in person. Thank you. And here you go. This is the. Okay. Oh, you have it up there.
Yeah.
Okay. Rabbi is keeping on a very tight schedule. We have to make sure we start on time. Okay. Are you guys okay with me not keeping to the exact order of the class?
Sure. Why not?
Oh, I'm just making sure everybody is. Well, no. Thank you. Yeah, we're gonna stick with this week's parsha. We're definitely gonna stay on to that. But the way they set up the class is interesting.
You can change the order.
Okay, well then
order.
Yeah, something like that. Yes, that's the idea.
If you want to know, that's been done before.
I don't know if it's done before. If you guys are okay with it, if it's done before.
Reading. I can be door person. I'll sit outside. In this letter to you, it says to take ownership of the class.
Okay, perfect. There we go. So I will take ownership. All right. Okay, we are at 7:30, so we will get started. Thank you, everyone, and welcome back. All right, so as I mentioned to those who heard, we're going to do things in a little bit different order here as far as they have it laid out. And again, the title is interesting. The Elusive Fifth Element. That's the title of the class, but we're Parshas Va'era. That's our class this week. And so let's first get started with just the overview of this week's Parsha. So we ended off last week's Torah portion with after Moshe comes into Pharaoh and asks to let the people go, Pharaoh says no and doubles down on the slavery of the Jews, makes them go collect their own straw to make the stones. And we ended off the Parsha with Moshe challenging God, why have you done bad or evil to your people? And so that's where we ended. And this week's Parsha starts off, this week's portion starts off with the continuation of that conversation between God and Moshe about what's going on. God says, I'm going to reveal to you what I haven't revealed to your forefathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I will redeem the Jewish people, the famous four languages of redemption that are the reason, or according to some, why we have four cups of wine on Pesach is because of these four languages that God uses. Then it's an interesting diversion. The Torah takes a moment to give us the history of who Moshe and Aaron are. So we don't have a full history of the Jewish people. We only have the history of Moshe. So the first three tribes, Reuven, Shimon, and then Levi, and then Moshe and Aaron are children of Levi through the son of Kehas, Yitzhar, Amram, and then Moshe and Aaron, which is interesting because we've already been introduced to Moshe last week. And the Torah did not find the need to give us the family history of them. Here it does. That's an interesting conversation, not today's class. But and the Torah then goes back to the conversation with Moshe and Aaron, and we have the famous, beginning of the 10 plagues. We have the first seven in this week's portion, and the final three in next week's portion. So that's basically this week's Parsha in a nutshell. And we're going to be focusing on the conversation around the plagues. So a little bit of introduction prior to us getting into that. The plagues were not a punishment per se to the Egyptians. While it is described that way, that God is sort of punishing the Egyptians for what they did to the Jews, but God is not, we don't believe God to be a angry or necessarily vengeful God in the sense of what a vengeful person would do. So if he was, it would make sense that he would want to get back at the Egyptians. But in this case, we have to say there's something more to it. The plagues, in a sense, were the process of purification of Egypt. The Jewish people descended into Egypt and were required to do something there. We mentioned this a little bit last week's Torah portion, that the Jews were going to refine and bring out from Egypt what was sort of embedded there spiritually, and the plagues were the process of this taking out. Okay, so that's sort of the introduction of where we're holding, what our conversation is about what, something about the plague specifically. So I would want, this is where I want to go a little bit out of order, and go to page, in the booklet, it's called the optional section. I'm not sure if you guys have that. It's would be page 28 in your booklets.
Can you put it on the screen?
Yes, I will. I just wanted to make sure that I have it here. And it is text 7. So text 7 in your booklets. Okay, so here, they don't actually have it here. I apologize. It is the optional section. So I will, and anyways, it's a very long section, and I don't want us to read the whole thing. If you guys are familiar with the Haggadah, with the Passover Haggadah, there's a very interesting conversation there regarding the 10 plagues. And that is, there's a discussion about how many plagues were there. So it says that there were 10 plagues in Egypt, and then there were 50 at the sea. The reason, where do we get this from, is because it says that God in Egypt revealed his finger onto Egypt, or he used his finger to punish Egypt. And if the finger was 10, and then it mentions by the splitting of the Red Sea, God uses his hand, 5 fingers, so therefore 50 plagues. What they were specifically, what that means, is not so much the focus of our class. But there is an argument between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva regarding how many plagues actually happened in Egypt. So Rabbi Eliezer says that every plague in Egypt was actually made up of 4. And so if the Jews had 40 in Egypt, there were then 200 on the sea. Rabbi Akiva says each plague in Egypt was made up of 5 plagues. So it was 50 in Egypt and 250 at the sea. So our conversation really is, what does that mean and what's going on here and what is the reason for their argument? And we are not talking here about actual plagues. Or the plague of blood was the plague of blood. The Nile turned into blood and all the water in Egypt was blood, and that was it. So what is their argument? And again, I'm sorry, we do not have the text here. It would have been text 8, unless it's at the end of your booklet, maybe. Let me see if it's here. I may be able to pull it up. Yes. Okay. Yes. If you keep going in your class. Okay. Right. So we have text 8. Okay. So we have text 8, and this describes, so we're going to start here with the locals, and then we're going to go to the Zoom. So Howard or Charna, if you guys want to take on reading text 8, and I have it here up on the screen.
Rabbi Eliezer, who maintains that each plague consisted of 4 plagues, is of the opinion that the plagues infiltrated not just the completed form, but also its 4 constituent elements. Rabbi Akiva, who maintains that each plague consisted of 5 plagues, is of the opinion that each plague attacked not only the elements, but also the generic state from which they emerged.
Okay, so we had a lot of words there, but what exactly does that mean? So first of all, this comes, in the text they have the name of Rabbi Yom Tov HaSvili, which is called a Ritva, but really the source of his words is a book called the Kolbo. Kolbo literally means everything in it. It is a book that we do not know the origin of, meaning we don't know who wrote it. There are different opinions who wrote it. We're not exactly sure. But he brings, the Ritva brings it as well, that the argument between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva regarding, did the plagues affect just the 4 elements or also the 5th element, which is the title of the class, right? The elusive 5th element. Okay, so all this is in our introduction to our class. Okay, so we know now that there were either 40 plagues or 50 plagues, but really we're not talking about the amount of plagues, but according to Rabbi Eliezer, each plague affected all 4 elements, and according to Rabbi Akiva, it affected also the 5th. So now we need to go back to the beginning and understand, what are we talking about? What are these elements? And in a way, all these elements are elusive elements. So we will now return back to the beginning of our class. And we have our introduction here. And so the framework of these questions are, when you go to a restaurant, what is your main thing you're looking for to experience in the restaurant? What is the key element, right? That is the question, right? So it's interesting, right? So I want to add my own little definition here about restaurants. And this is a pet peeve of mine, so humor me if you don't mind. In Atlanta, we don't have any kosher restaurants. We have several kosher eateries. And I make a distinction between a restaurant and an eatery. A restaurant is a place for an experience. An eatery is where you go to grab a bite to eat. Most of the so-called restaurants in Atlanta, I would qualify as eateries. There's no real focus on ambiance, service, and not even special food. It's just kosher food. And if you keep kosher, then you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. You either go out to eat at these so-called restaurants, or you don't. And they know it, and we know it, so things straight. But let's assume we're talking about real restaurants. What makes a restaurant a restaurant? What's so special about it? The floor is open. If you feel, by all means, share your... they have a few options here in the introduction. Is it the food? Is it the service? Is it the establishment? There are other things as well.
Vibe.
Okay. Yes. Vibe is definitely something that's important in a restaurant. Anybody else want to take a stab? I'm sorry?
Service.
Okay. So yes. So friendly, cheerful service is one of the options. That's correct. Service is important. Okay. Well, those are the options. So we'll stick with those. The answer, I believe, is all, right? All these things are important. When you're going to a restaurant, you're going for an experience. And the experience is a combination of all the different components that make up your experience. It's, of course, interesting food. Service is important. The vibe and ambiance that you feel when you come into the restaurant. The cleanliness of the restaurant is important. All these things contribute to the overall experience. And we'll get to, at the end of the class, hopefully, what we would think would be the main thing. What would overcome any shortcomings the restaurant has if they provide that specific item? And so, yes?
I emailed you the double-sided chapter 2.
It's all good.
It's all okay?
We're good. Thank you so much, Bridget. Appreciate you. Okay, so, right. That was the second introduction, yes, to get us into the mindset of what we're trying to get to at the end. So let's get back to the, and we'll start here in text 2, the idea of these four elements. So let's first read from Maimonides, who is the, I believe, first mainstream Jewish text that actually discusses this. It has been discussed before Maimonides, but he's the first one who brings it as a common concept within Judaism. So, Howard, maybe you can read for us text number 1. I'm sorry. Why don't I have text 1 here? This client is very interesting. I'm sorry, guys. I'm trying to find it on the... Yeah, but this the text she has here. Hold on, maybe it's here. I only have text 2. I don't have text number 1 for some reason in that handout. Oh, you know what? She mentioned to me it's because
the backside.
It's the backside. So,
yeah,
I can't. All right, I apologize, guys, about our technical difficulties. I'll have Howard read it, and then I'll summarize it for those who can't hear. By all means, go ahead, Howard.
These four bodies, fire, wind, water, and earth, are the fundamental elements of all that was created under the sky. The body of everything that exists, be it human, beast, fowl, crawling creature, fish, plant, metal, precious stone, pearl, building stone, mountain, or lump of earth is a combination of these four fundamental elements.
Okay, so according to Maimonides, and this is the Jewish theory, so we're not talking here about elements like on the periodic table, chemistry elements. We are talking about prior to that, meaning according to Jewish thought, and this is all-inclusive, meaning this is pretty much accepted by all Jewish thinkers, is that everything is made up of these four elements, fire, wind, water, and earth. Some explain it to mean everything is made up of heat, cold, dry, and moist. So those are the four, right? So fire, of course, would be heat, wind would be cold, water is moist, and earth would be dry. And again, according to Judaism, those are the building blocks of the universe. There's actually, the way it's described in Judaism is that the world is made up of orbits, galgalim, these like onion shells around the earth. And the highest of the, within our world is the circle of fire, right below the circle of the moon. So the orbit of the moon, below that is an orbit of fire. Below that, that of wind. Below that, that of water. And below that, that of earth. And again, we're not getting into the scientific discussion and how this corresponds. There are some interesting explanations. If we get into that, we won't finish tonight. So we will we'll pass on that. But we'll accept that for now, that there are four elements. You could read here text two if either Steve or Adele would like to read text number two.
I'll read.
Please.
Go ahead, Adele. I'll read next.
The elements that our sages addressed are not foundational in the sense of being indestructible and indivisible. They are foundational in the sense that everything that exists is comprised of them. They are also irrelevant to the chemical elements. There are those who understand these elements as characteristics such as cold, wet, hot, dry, etc. That is why our sages called them characteristics of nature.
Okay, so that's from the Rebbe brings that down, and it's a part of it is based on the Medrash. But okay, again, as we said, we're not talking about chemistry. Now, in addition to this, there's in text three, and Steve, you can read that one. Okay. We just want to talk about mention it first, and then we'll get into discuss a little bit more.
Okay. Then there is a fifth generic element that encompasses all four elements. Unlike the four elements that emerge from it, the fifth element has no physical definition.
Thank you. Okay, so in Jewish literature, it's referred to as chomer. Chomer means substance. Hiyuli. Hiyuli, nobody really knows what it means, but it means this abstract element. If you will, I like calling it the primordial ooze. I think used in science, right? There was the primordial ooze that from there all life came, right? So in Judaism, we see it this way. There's a generic substance, which is abstract and undefined. From there, it breaks down into four separate elements that from there, everything is created. Now, when we say that everything exists is made up of these things, we're not referring to literal fire and literal earth. Right, we have within us these four elements according to Judaism, but we don't have fire in us. A spontaneous combustion is a science fiction concept that doesn't really exist, at least not hasn't been proven yet. And so too, we don't have earth in us. So what this means is that there's a dominant element, if you will, if we think of these as primary elements. So there's a concept of water, of moisture, and so we have moisture in us. We have blood, and we have other liquids in our bodies, and so on and so forth. So everything is made up of these things. Okay, so this is we have to understand this in order to understand what's going on with the plagues. And so going back to what we mentioned with Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, we'll understand now what the Kobo says. According to Rabbi Eliezer, the plagues affected only the four elements. And according to Rabbi Akiva, it also affected the fifth and generic, if you will, element. Okay, so in a sense, the conversation then becomes, or the argument between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva is, how deep did the plagues affect Egypt? Did it affect just the four elements that are more visible relative to the generic element or not? And so to really understand this, we have to give an analogy, but we'll give another concept where we see this. In Judaism, we know of non-kosher food, right? Non-kosher food, you can't eat, right? That's level one of non-kosher food. There's a more intense prohibition of non-kosher food, which you cannot derive benefit from either. For example, the mixture of milk and meat cannot be used for any benefit. That is why it is very complicated for an Orthodox Jew to go to culinary school. Because while he may not taste anything, or she may not taste anything, the actual cooking of a mixture of milk and meat will actually qualify as a prohibition, because you're deriving benefit from it. Deriving benefit can mean anything. It can mean feeding it to your animal, using it as an ointment. In all these cases, that would be prohibited. Okay, so that's a deeper level. And then we have finally the deepest level, you cannot have it. It can't be in your possession. And that, for example, is chametz on Pesach. Chametz on Pesach, right? We cannot, not only can we not eat it, and we cannot derive benefit from it, but it's not allowed to be in our possession. We're not supposed to even see it. That's how intense the prohibition is. So there is an analogy here, which I like very much, that they brought down here in the preparation of the class, so I'll use it. If there's a machine broken, and you hire an engineer, mechanic to come fix this broken machine. So the first thing is to check the external parts of the machine to see if something broke, if something is wrong with this machine from the outside. Just visibly check. That just reminded me of a story. I'll tell the story. There was a shipyard where they had a very large ship which stopped working. And they called all the different mechanics and engineers, and nobody can figure out how to get this machine to work. And finally, one of the members of the administration said, "I heard of a guy that he's a really old man, but he supposedly is a genius when it comes to ships. Let's call the guy." So they do, and he comes with a little bag of tools, and he walks around the ship, and he's feeling and he's touching, and finally he comes to a spot on the ship. He takes out from his toolbox a hammer. And he gives a bang on the wall, and the ship roars to life. Beautiful. So then he sends them an invoice, $100,000. They send him back a message. Are you crazy? $100,000 for banging on the wall with your hammer? That's ridiculous. He says, no problem. I'll send you an updated invoice. So he sends them an invoice, updated invoice, and it says, banging with the hammer on the ship, $1,000. Knowing where to bang, $99,000, right? So that's just a side story, not really related to what we're talking about, but this idea that an engineer looks at a machine from the outside can see, okay, something is broken. On the external surface of the machine, okay, he fixes it. Can't find a problem there. He goes in deeper to the components of the machine and to see if there's something wrong that broke on the inside, a pipe, a belt, or... I'm not an engineer, so I don't know all the names of the components, but something on the inside is broken. Again, that is a deeper level of understanding of the machine. And then finally, if that doesn't work, the engineer will consider, is there a flaw in the design of the machine? Now, this is not something specific that you can point to. It's very esoteric. But he can say, oh, this was a mistake, the way they built this machine. The design here was incorrect. Okay, so we have three layers here, and these are equivalent to our three layers of prohibition when it comes to food. Prohibition number one is a food which only in its current presentation, as it is presented to us, is forbidden. In the initial state of it, it can be used. For example, non-kosher food, excuse me, meat from a non-kosher animal, it is only prohibited when it's presented to us in eating form. But in its initial state, we can have pleasure from it. We can still buy it and sell it. We can ride a horse. We can touch non-kosher animals. We don't have that prohibition. There are some religions that don't eat animals and they don't touch those animals either. We don't have such a prohibition. And then you have a prohibition which is so deep that it goes into the essence of what the thing is. And in that case, we can't be involved in it in any way, shape, or form. To just touch on, again, we're missing the text, so I'm going to ask Sharna here to read the text number 4, just to understand a little bit more, give us some frame of reference when it comes to prohibition of food. So text number 4, please.
Forbidden foods are called asur, tied down. If someone eats some erroneously for the sake of heaven, intending to use its nourishment to study Torah or pray, the nourishment does not attach to the words of Torah and prayer. It can't become holy. It is tied down to unholiness.
Thank you. So the idea here is that something that's prohibited is locked from our use. But as we just said, there are levels of that prohibition and layers to how prohibited it is. And in a way, this ties into what we're discussing here, which is how much is affected and how much do we have to touch on. So let's read now text number 5A. If somebody would like to read, who's joining us on Zoom, text 5A, I have it up on the screen, or it's on page 25 in your booklets, if you have the booklet.
I've got my audio working.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. When we eat something, we benefit from its finished form, the edible form. We don't interact with the elements that form the food. When we derive benefit from something, we interact with the elements that form it.
Thank you. So again, we are delving deeper into what the thing is. And simply put, if we're going to a restaurant and eating a burger, we're eating the burger. We're not necessarily interacting with how it became this specific burger with these components and these layers. If we do, that actually is a deeper understanding, right? Somebody who's a chef and eats a really good burger, he will appreciate the elements that made up this burger. And, they sous vide the meat for 3 hours first, and they blanched this and that and the other, and there's all these components that come into it, but that's a deeper layer. For on the surface level, just enjoying the burger, it's a good burger, great. So again, prohibitions go in the same way on these layers, on these levels. And so certain things, again, are forbidden to eat, certain things are forbidden to even derive pleasure from, and certain things are forbidden to even have.
A comment, a question.
Sure, go ahead.
So if a non-kosher animal, if a kosher animal ate something that's non-kosher,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't affect the kosherness of the animal.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
Yes, so once the kosher animal ate the non-kosher food, it became absorbed into the kosher animal, is now part of the kosher animal. So I'm allowed to eat the kosher animal. Now, it depends, by the way. So for example, if a kosher fish swallowed a non-kosher fish whole, and then you caught this kosher fish, you cannot just empty out its insides and eat the non-kosher food because it came out of a kosher animal. It doesn't work that way. But interestingly enough, if a kosher animal, for example, a kosher cow, gave birth to an animal that looks like a pig, somehow the animal came out deformed, looking like a pig, you're allowed to eat that animal because it is a piece of, it came out of the kosher animal as a, right? It wasn't installed there. It wasn't swallowed by it. And that's the, and vice versa is the same thing. If a pig, for example, gave birth to an animal that somehow looks like a cow, you cannot eat the cow. By the way, this is a very interesting conversation, and we don't want to get lost into it now because it's a major diversion. But this is an interesting conversation. What causes an animal to be kosher or not? We won't get into that. Okay. So foods, we have these different layers of things that are forbidden. So if we tie it into our idea of elements, right? Something that's forbidden just to eat is the way the elements have been combined into their current form. Something that's forbidden to also have benefit from is prohibited at the level of elements. Something that's forbidden to even own is forbidden or unholy at its esoteric level, sort of the generic energy source that makes this thing be. And so, again, the tying into what we discussed. All right, so what does this have to do with what we're talking about? Of course, it has to do with the question of what was, to what extent did the plagues have to purify Egypt? To what layer did it have to reach? So if you say the plagues just were one plague, then what you're saying is it was only a surface level problem. The unholiness of Egypt was just at the external level. And once you dealt with that, then everything else is fine. According to Rabbi Eliezer, that says that it was four plagues. What we're saying is that the unholiness of Egypt extended to the elements that make up Egypt as well. And according to Rabbi Akiva, the what happened, we had to get down to the deepest, deepest core of what Egypt represents. I want to take a side note here just to talk about these the idea of these elements. This applies also to a human being. A human being is made up of, as you're presented, who you are in your entirety. You're also, on a deeper level, made up of components, right? Your personality, your intellect, your talents. But that's already breaking it down to elements that make up who you are. Who you are is just who you are. And then there's something even deeper, your essence. So I want to talk about the term essence for a moment, and because it's important here. In Hasidic terminology, the word is etzem, very similar to actually the word essence. So the word is etzem. Etzem means the essence of something. What is the essence of something? So the way it was taught to me when I was in yeshiva was by posing the following question. If I have an apple, what component do I need to take away from the apple for it to no longer be an apple? Meaning, what is the essence of the apple that if I were to remove it, the apple would no longer be? Anyone?
The texture.
The texture? Well, that's the texture of the apple. If you have an apple that has is rotten, it's a rotten apple. The essence of the apple is still here. Anybody have suggestions?
The seeds.
The seeds of the apple. Well, again, those are the seeds of the apple. I am sure if they haven't yet developed those, they can develop seedless apples like they have seedless watermelon. Right? So again, it's a component of the apple. It's not the essence of the apple. What then is the essence of the apple? I'm sorry?
How about pectin? Pectin is what makes again, apple an apple.
Is a compound which exists in an apple. Were you to produce an apple that doesn't have that compound, it would not make it a not apple. It would just make it an apple that's weird.
Well, it would be the flesh of the apple.
Okay, again, so if I have the peel of the apple without any flesh, I still have a peel of an apple, so I haven't removed the essence of the apple here.
The shape.
Okay, so what I'll say is this. In order for you to remove the apple, you have to remove the entirety of the apple. It's either all or nothing. The essence of something is a yes or no. It's a binary question. It either is or isn't. We actually, today, this ties in very much to the idea of DNA, because we know in any particle of the apple, you have the entire DNA makeup of that apple, whether it's the peel or the flesh or the compound. You can break it down. It's all there. So in order to remove the apple, you have to remove the entirety of the apple, or you always have an apple here. You can eat an apple and you still have the apple because the core of the apple is still here, and so on and so forth. And this applies to everything in the world. The essence of something is that which is, that makes it be, that in order to remove it, the entirety of the thing must be removed. Now, again, going back to our analogy of the elements, the essence of the Jew or of a person is just that, that he is. Or she is. The elements is the compounds that make up the shape that it will then later present to the world. He or she will present to the world. So who I am, what you see, is made up of what you're seeing here, made up of my elements, my different components that make me who I am. But deeper than that is just my essence. I am or I am not. Simple. Yes? Binary. Yes or no? I'll make a silly joke. There was a guy who came to a rabbi told a guy he has a shidduch for him. Great, great girl. Phenomenal girl. She has a small problem. But she's great. And he said, what's the problem? He said, is she ugly? He said, no, she's beautiful. He said, is she stupid? And he said, no, she's smart. She's talented and accomplished in life. Does she come from a bad family? No, she's great family. So what's wrong with her? He says, she's a little bit pregnant. the point is, it's a yes or no. Yes, it's a yes or no question. It's not something that's up for discussion of nuance. There's no nuance there. Yes, it's a yes or no. Again, you can use the same story with other things. It's just the way I heard it, and I thought it was funny. I apologize if I offended anybody. Okay, so we have here these idea of these components, these layers, and again, we're not necessarily talking from a scientific level. We are talking about the as it is in Torah thought.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Sure, by all means.
Is your essence in your DNA, or is that separate from your DNA?
That's a great question. I don't think your essence is in your DNA. I think your essence is an esoteric, it's an idea of you. It's not something that you can touch. It is, but it's not something that can be defined in any way, shape, or form.
Wouldn't your DNA be part of your essence?
All your components are part of your essence, but they're not your essence. They're your shape that you take. It's an esoteric concept. It's like this idea of this component, this matter that all matter comes from, but it's not an actual matter. It's not some kind of a glob of something that then is turned into other things. It's more of an idea. Sorry?
Is your essence your soul?
No, your essence would not be your soul. Your soul is, so if I ask you, I think I mentioned this last week with the Zayde, right? He asked, who is Zayde? The Tzemach Tzedek, the grandson of the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe, wanted to know who was his grandfather, and he kept pointing, this is my beard, this is my, and then he called him and he turned towards him and he said, oh, that's who you are. Meaning your essence is everything of you. Your soul, your body, your DNA, but none of those things specifically. If you will, just give another example. In Hasidic terminology, there's an idea, there's something that's general and something that's specific. There's two types of something that's called general. There can be something general that's made up of components, and that's what makes it a general. So my computer is a general thing, but it's not a general concept. It's a word that I use to define a combination of components that make up a computer. But then there are things that are general. Let's talk about this. I'll use human beings as an example. A nation of people is a combination of multiple people. So that's what makes it up. But the species, human being, Homo sapiens, is not made up of individuals. You can have no individuals of Homo sapiens and you'll still have the species of Homo sapien, right? It's not dependent on details. And that's part of, or a similar concept, the idea of essence. It's not something that's made up of components, it just is. Okay, let's put a pause on that because that's not really our main focus of conversation today, but we'll maybe get to it a little bit more if we have some time, because we're starting to run low and again, we have to be very on top of this, not going beyond our time. So I want to now go to text. I'm actually going to go to text 10 here. If somebody wants to read it, this is actually from a foodserviceandhospitality.com. So this is not a Jewish source, but this is an interesting point going back to our conversation about what makes a good restaurant. If somebody would like to read.
I'll read.
Oh, Adele, please.
What is most important in a restaurant, food, service, or atmosphere? This is a loaded question. While I believe that all three need to be executed to the highest standard, whether in quick service restaurants, casual, or fine dining operations, I also believe that service and atmosphere are the two most important ingredients in making a restaurant successful. I apologize in advance to all the chefs who are going to complain about this comment. This is not to say that the food quality and consistency are not also important. They are, but they are really secondary. The reality is that for the most part, people go out to either fill up, spend time with friends, or dine out. It is only in 2% of restaurants that people go to dine out to experience the chef's creation, in which food would, in my world, need to be as good as the service. But in the end, service is what the hospitality business is all about. Great food does not make up for mediocre service. However, great service can offset mediocre food. In fact, it does at almost every quick service, family and casual chain out there. Those restaurants make up the vast majority of our industry and are the most popular with customers as well. Focus first on great service. Then make sure the atmosphere reflects the environment you want your customers to enjoy. And then put out the best food that you can.
Thank you. So this leads us into this statement, which I think is very true in most cases, to an interesting comparison we can find in Torah. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Shema. This is not something in the booklet. This is I want to bring this in because I think it's going to help us understand this even better. The point that we're trying to make here is that when to translate these ideas of the elements to practical service of God, we have to understand layers of service. So there's serving God by just doing what God says tells us to do. God says put on tefillin, you put on tefillin. God says to keep Shabbos, we keep Shabbos. Then there's a layer of doing it more intentfully, with feeling, with love, with excitement. And then there's going beyond that. In the Shema, we say, V'ahavtas Hashem lekecha, you should love God, your God, or God, your Lord, Lord, your God. And it uses three terms, b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, v'chol meidecha, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your meidecha. What?
Might.
Okay, so the word meid, if you look it up, the word meid translates as very, right? Yafe meod means very nice. Yafe means nice. Meod is very. So b'chol meidecha really means with all your very. What does that mean? So b'chol levavcha, we can say, means your external personhood. So you should serve God with your heart, meaning who you are as a person. Do the things God wants you to do. B'chol nafshecha, with all your soul, means going beyond just doing what you need to do, but actually enjoying it and appreciating it and being part of it. With your very means going beyond, above and beyond. Doing it with all your very. Again, I like that translation better. Usually it's translated in the Jewish literature, b'chol ma'idecha would mean with all your money. Because for most people, or for a lot of people, their money is their very. Right, that's where it really comes down to. People get really touchy when it comes to their personal belongings, their stuff. That's where people get, oh, that's mine. Right? You know the story with the Russians came to a small village and they grabbed the guy and says, "Do you love Mother Russia?" Says, "Yeah, I love Mother Russia." And if you had 1,000 cows, will you give them to the Tsar? He says, "Sure, I'll give them to the Tsar." He said, "If you had 100 horses, will you give them to the Tsar?" He says, "Yes, I'll give them to the Tsar." So if you had 2 chickens, will you give them to the Tsar? He says, "No, absolutely not." He says, "You got 1,000 cows you would give to the Tsar, and 100 horses you give to the Tsar, the 2 chickens you won't?" He says, 2 chickens I have. right? Meaning, when it comes to ideas, yes, we'll do everything. But when it comes to our very, that's when we get very touchy. So, the example, I guess, would be is if you're sitting at a football game if you enjoy football, I don't enjoy it. I don't like sports, but let's just say you're at an opera or a movie or whatever it is, or at your favorite restaurant, if we're going to keep the theme of restaurants, and you realize you forgot to pray. So you may just, you know, get up and, as we say, knock off a prayer to fulfill your obligation. You may go so far as finding a little corner and really taking the time to pray properly. And even beyond that, you can forget about the restaurant and realize, oh my God, I have to pray. This is more important than anything else. I'm going to go find a shul and I'm going to daven and I'm going to forget about the restaurant. That is your very. That's giving up who you are. Egypt represents the constrictions of our life and the boundaries we place upon ourselves. And what we're learning here about the plagues is the goal of the plagues is to break down those boundaries. Excuse me. And so Rabbi Eliezer says we need to go a little bit deeper than just dealing with the problem. We have to understand the cause of the problem, but we don't necessarily have to go deeper than that. Our very is something we can't touch. And Rabbi Akiva says we can go further. We can actually touch our very. And in the terminology here, we're referring to the fifth element. I just want to read one last, I apologize about the text. We don't have the last text here. We have the last text. We're going to read text 12, but first I'm going to read text 11b. I'm just going to read that. Sadness is not a sin. However, the worst sin can't turn off our hearts as much as sadness. A Jew who fails to rejoice over the pleasures of being a Jew is ungrateful to God. This is a quote from Rabbi Aaron Karlin. He was a student of the Masricher Magid, the teacher of the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe. And he touches on a point here. It is a mitzvah to serve God with joy. It's not considered to be a sin to be sad, but sadness is worse than anything else. It stops you from doing everything. That is really the fifth element that we're talking about here. The idea of going down to the deepest level of who we are and bringing that up. And the goal of the plagues was to address that problem. The goal of the plagues was to really eradicate from the Jewish people all that Egypt represents. And the question is how deep you need to go. And we very much hold like Rabbi Akiva in many, many things. Rabbi Akiva is considered to be the author of most Mishnahs. And most halachas go according to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is considered a major contributor to Judaism. And so Rabbi Akiva is telling us that in order for us to deal with our struggles, meaning to really serve God properly, we have to go down to our very. We need. It's not enough just to do what we need to do. It's not enough even to enjoy what we do. We need to go deeper. We have to go to our very. And I want to read text 12 here. If somebody, Howard, maybe you can read our final text here, which I think is very important. It's tying this all back to the whole restaurant thing.
Humans want to feel valued. They want to feel like everything they say is heard and understood. And you are the trusted supplier to make that happen. Even if their mind is elsewhere, knowing that yours is on them will cement your company and its caring ethos in their memory. Adnan Ali, a former restaurant owner, remembers a time when a regular customer dined without his partner. Knowing that he normally came with her, we asked to see if she was okay, and he let us know she had the flu. Before the customer left, we packed up some freshly made soup and some other menu items for him to take home to her on the house. The team's gesture was super appreciated, resulting in lots of positive feedback.
This is a quote from a woman named Jody Cook in a book called 6 Ways to Go the Extra Mile for Your Customers. And I think this summarizes the idea. This was not something that the restaurant needed to do, were required to do, or even asked to do. But they noticed there was some situation here, and they went above and beyond. When it comes to serving God, that's what the message of the plagues, according to Rabbi Akiva, is. The goal is not just to check off our requirements, and it's not only to be involved emotionally in Judaism. It's to really dig deeper and address, like I keep referring to it as our true essence, that which, you know, where we don't want to give. We don't want to give the chickens because we have them. Judaism cannot just be something we do as part of us. It's our essence. And I think we mentioned this last week, and I'll mention it again, something that has been brought home to us very much in the last few months. Being a Jew is an essential thing. I had several months prior to the events of October 7th, I was learning with some individuals, and one of them mentioned that the reason why we're hated is because we dress differently. That the Jews in Europe always dressed, you know, I look funny. I don't look like your typical, you know, when I go to a business meeting, I stick out, right? I have my tzitzis hanging out. I have a beard that's, not unkempt, but not trimmed in any way. I wear a yarmulke. I typically don't shake hands with women. I stick out. And so he was claiming that that's why we're hated, because we do funny things. And if we would just be more assimilated. And as we've learned over the last 100 years, especially, that's not the case. And even in 2023, people see us as Jews just because we're Jews, not because of anything else. It's an essential thing of us. And so the goal of the plagues, the message we can learn from this idea, this argument between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, is that we have to embrace that essence of who we are. And we have to make sure that the boundaries don't affect that part of us. That part of us has to also be released and be beyond just, again, doing or even feeling. But it has to be who we are. We have to dig down to our essence, to our very. And then we can really, truly serve God in the most proper way. And to summarize our question in the beginning, what makes a restaurant special is when you go into the restaurant and you feel that they're giving you their very. It's not about their food. It's not even about the service. This story that we had in the end, where it's not the details of what they did. It's what's behind it. They cared so much about their customer that they wanted to make sure that their customer is taken care of. That's not a component. It's not a feature in a restaurant. It's not a free, you know, mint and toothpick at the end of your meal that makes you feel good. Or it's beyond that. It's recognizing the essence of what's going on here and touching that. And that's really what our goal is in serving God, is to really get down to our very. And with that, I'll conclude today's class. I'll give you the have at the end. I don't know if you guys have it, the key points. Mm-hmm. Right, so everything that exists is comprised of four elements. We discussed that. There's a fifth element, an intangible sphere, in which the four elements exist in a generic state. We are forbidden to eat things that are unholy in their fully formed state. And we are forbidden to benefit from things in which the unholiness has drilled down to their constituent elements. And we are even forbidden even to possess things that have become whole, either become or have been determined by God to be unholy at their core. And humans also have these four elements. We didn't really touch on this, but the idea of action, speech, thought, and desire, this can actually be broken down in different ways of what our four makeups are. But there's our fifth element, our very core, our essence, who we are. To have a connection to God, we must serve him with all our four elements, but not just our actions and words, but also our minds and hearts. However, to forge a complete connection, we must give him our very core. This means that nothing is indispensable when it comes to God. We are ready to do anything or give up anything to please him. That's our essence. That's who we are. And that's how we really connect to God in the ultimate way and differentiate ourselves from everybody else. L'chaim, l'chaim. By all means, any questions? We have officially 7 minutes left for the class. If you want this, whatever. I'm going to stop here for a second, let you guys, if you have any comments.
Okay. So is basically your essence, your neshama?
Adele mentioned that earlier. It's your neshama, as we usually talk about it, is a thing, right? It's our spiritual selves. So that's not our core. Our core goes deeper than that. As it says in Tanya, if anybody here has ever been in a Tanya class, The Alter Rebbe refers to a concept of the peace of God that is us. And that's not our soul. We are a piece of God. And actually what's usually described, the Baal Shem Tov uses this terminology. If you grab a piece of the essence, you have the entirety of the essence. As we mentioned earlier, right? If you have a piece of the apple, you have the whole apple. Being that we're a piece of God, that means in a sense, we are God. Now, I know that sounds very, it can take it different ways. I don't mean that we have the powers of God and that we can create and all that. But in a sense, we are just part, and not a part as a detail, but we are all encompassed in the essence of God. And that's our essence. So it's not our soul, because our soul is almost a spiritual being of us. It's beyond that. Our core is beyond that. Our essence is even more than that. It's almost the idea of us, which makes us our core. And by the way, just to in the plagues, just where we're talking about plagues, and we have a few minutes. The plagues, in a sense, deal with the things that we need to address. So, for example, the first plague is the plague of blood, right? Blood represents passion, water represents coolness, certain steadiness. Our first job is to become uncold when it comes to life, and especially to godliness, and to divert our passion to the world, to passion for God. So I don't know. I'm assuming some people here are into sports. I know I have family members that are sports fanatics, some to the extent of knowing what's going on with the Kentucky Derby, which to me is, he follows football and baseball and hockey and soccer and cricket and the Kentucky Derby. He's very passionate about sports, extremely passionate. That's the kind of passion. We know that passion. Whatever you're passionate about, imagine if somebody said, let's go do or participate in that thing. Whether it's a sport or watch a movie or go to a restaurant, whatever your passion is, you know how you feel when somebody mentions that. Oh, we're going to go to a restaurant? I'm super excited. Our goal, first goal in breaking the boundaries of ourselves is to divert our passion. It's not saying that you should necessarily cut it off entirely. You want to follow sports, but the passion needs to be for God. And then you have the frogs represent this idea we just talked about here. One of the interesting components about the frogs don't like heat. Some of you guys went to high school. I know there was a time where they dissect frogs. I don't know if they still do that in science, but I think one of the things is they put the frog in hot water, right, to see how it reacts, and they keep heating up the water. They don't do these things today, but this was something they used to do, right? They would put a frog in water, and it would slowly heat the water, and then ultimately the frog would die without realizing that the water was hot. But typically, this was public school, American public school.
The frogs were dead when we got them.
Oh, okay. So maybe I'm talking about a study that was just done outside of a public school. The point, though, is the frogs don't like heat. And yet in Egypt, one of the things that it tells us in the Torah, in the biblical verses, that the frogs jumped into the ovens of the Egyptians. Right, they went everywhere, including into their ovens, which tells us that the frogs, in order to serve God, went beyond their very nature. Right, they did something that was not something that they would typically do. They don't like humans, and they hide away. But here they went into the humans' houses and even into their ovens to fulfill God's desire. So that's layer number two. And so all the rest of the plagues as well all represent a way of breaking ourselves, and that's really the purpose of it. God wasn't necessarily punishing the Egyptians. He could have punished them much more swiftly and concisely rather than going through this whole process. The process was more than just punishing them. It was more about breaking and teaching us the lesson. I actually heard some say that the plagues never actually happened. We generally take the Torah to mean literally, right? If the Torah says there were 10 plagues, there were 10 plagues. But there are those that say it's the more focus of the plagues is what they represent, the idea of breaking the boundaries of Egypt. And you can, I'm sure somebody can build a psychological philosophy today to using those terminologies. And today everybody likes doing that. Everybody has a new idea of how to address yourself and how to deal with your being a human being. But the Torah starts and tells us that we need to break the boundaries and we need to reach down to that core, to that very. And that's what we're aiming for. Okay, we're not just trying to check off a list of, you know, God needs us to put on tefillin. So, okay, we put on tefillin. Now he's happy. Now we can go back to our life. That's not what we're trying to accomplish. We want to go more than that. Yes? All right. Well, thank you all for participating.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good class.
Thank you.
I appreciate you. All right.
Good jokes.
Bye.
Stories.